Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. Sorry, I forgot to turn my mic on. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. We are a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. I will be reading from The Sun. This is Diane, and Susan will be joining me, and she'll be reading from The Tribune. And we would like to say thank you to the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their continued support of us. Okay, headline news from The Sun. ICE arrests man facing rape and indecent exposure charges. Out of Billerica. An illegal immigrant from Guatemala wanted on several sex crimes in Massachusetts, including rape and indecent exposure charges, has been arrested in Billerica by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE Boston says Raquel Ordonez Cruz, 23, was apprehended last week after he was arrested by Arlington police on numerous sex crimes last month, including assault to rape, indecent assault and battery on a person 14 years or older, and indecent exposure. ICE says agents arrested Ordonez Cruz July 21st at the Middlesex County House of Corrections after he was released from state custody. He was served with a notice to appear before a Justice Department immigration judge before being taken into custody at Enforcement and Removal Operations Boston's headquarters in Burlington. He has not only displayed a blatant disregard for laws by illegally entering the United States and later allegedly sexually assaulting our residents, he has also proven to be a threat to our neighborhoods, Acting Director of ERO Boston David Wessling told the Herald. The arrest of this alleged sex offender from the streets of Massachusetts shows our officers' dedication to the safety and security of our New England communities. We will not stop finding and arresting dangerous criminal alien offenders. ICE says it's not clear when or where Ordonez Cruz illegally entered the country without being inspected, admitted, or paroled by a U.S. immigration official. He will remain in ICE custody pending the outcome of this removal proceedings. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune in Haverhill report, former police chief lied. Deputy chief used derogatory language. In Haverhill, an investigation of the police department's leadership found that former chief Robert Pistone falsely blamed the mayor for key decisions following the death of Francis Gigliotti, one of several conclusions revealed in a newly released report. The report by Discrimination and Harassment Solutions, LLC, investigated complaints of misconduct against Pistone and Deputy Chief Stephen Daughtry after Mayor Melinda Barrett learned of issues in the department in early October. These complaints stemmed from the leadership's handling of Gigliotti's death during his attempted arrest July 2025. Police officers responded to reports that Gigliotti, 43, was acting erratically and restrained him before he became unresponsive. First responders attempted life-saving aid, and he was transported to a nearby hospital where he was later pronounced dead. Seven officers were placed on paid administrative leave while the Essex County District Attorney's Office investigated the incident. On September 5, the state medical examiner ruled Gigliotti's death a homicide caused by cardiac arrhythmia in a person with acute intoxication due to the combined effects of cocaine and ethanol while being restrained by police. The report stated that finding heightened concerns, the officers could face criminal charges, but the DA announced January 27 that officers acted in accordance with their training and in the interest of public safety and found no criminality. More criticism of Pistone and Daughtry poured in following the September 26 death of Caitlin Tully, one of the seven officers placed on administrative leave after the Gigliotti incident. Among the complaints were allegations the chief and deputy chief failed to support the suspended officers, falsely claimed the mayor or DA prevented them from publicly supporting the officers, retaliated against officers who challenged them, and made offensive comments. Pistone resigned effective October 9 and declined to participate in the investigation through his attorney. Daughtry participated in the investigation and argued that any misconduct was carried out by Chief Pistone, his superior. Investigators concluded Pistone falsely blamed Barrett for important decisions in the Gigliotti case to shield himself from negative blowback. He did so on at least three occasions, including telling department employees that the mayor decided they could not issue a public statement about the incident. The report said Barrett denied ever issuing such an order. The investigation also found Pistone falsely claimed Barrett directed him to reduce overtime for the seven officers on administrative leave from 8 hours per week to four. Barrett testified she never instructed this, and the report states Daughtry described Pistone's false statement as a betrayal. Daughtry was found to have frequently used derogatory language when referring to patrol officers. One witness described his behavior as humiliating and degrading toward officers. Although Daughtry acknowledged using expletives, he denied making some of the harsher remarks attributed to him. Investigators found that defense was not credible after four co-workers reported he used the word retard in a belittling manner. While there were several more allegations against Pistone and Daughtry, the report concluded that complaints alleging they failed to adequately support the seven officers reflected leadership decisions rather than policy violations. Whatever shortcomings are attributable to Chief Pistone, the report states, represents lapses in professional judgment, not policy violations. The report found insufficient evidence to substantiate policy violations related to the remaining complaints. Integrity and honesty have always been the foundation of this union, the Haverhill Police Patrolmen's Association stated after the findings. The release of this report we were given reinforces our belief and knowledge that these individuals, Pistone and Daughtry, were not fit to serve in leadership roles or represent our community. We will not recognize their former ranks. A memorandum of agreement between the city and Daughtry was also released and will resolve all disputes related to his employment in Haverhill. Daughtry has submitted an irrevocable resignation from his position as deputy police chief. His resignation is to take effect March 27, and he will be considered to have retired in good standing. Until it becomes effective, Daughtry will remain on paid administrative leave with benefits. He will continue receiving his current weekly salary of $4,565.97, prorated as necessary for the final pay period. Following his retirement, Daughtry will receive contractual obligations totaling more than $116,000, avoiding any further litigation. This money would come from the city's reserve account. His salary and benefits for the balance of time that he is on paid administrative leave would be paid from the police department salary line. This agreement is an important step forward in resolving management matters within the police department, Barrett said. With Chief Tracy's appointment as permanent police chief last month, we can now finalize the department's leadership team and continue with the excellent progress and stability the department has achieved over the past 8+ months. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have an odd story. eBay to pay nearly $50 million to a couple sent cockroaches and a bloody pig mask. Out of Boston, eBay Incorporated agreed to pay almost $50 million to a Massachusetts couple who said former employees of the company targeted them with threats and bizarre anonymous deliveries, including live insects, a funeral wreath, and a bloody pig Halloween mask, according to settlement details released Tuesday. The parties reported reaching a tentative settlement in February as the case was headed to trial, but they were unable to finalize it. David and Ina Steiner asked a federal judge in June to restore the case to the trial calendar and reach a new settlement this month. The agreement with Steiner's founders of e-commerce Bytes, a newsletter covering the e-commerce industry, includes an additional $7 million in charitable donations, including to organizations supporting First Amendment rights. The settlement contains no confidentiality provision, allowing the Steiners to discuss the case publicly. David and I were on the same page that this settlement should and must be made public, as victims who want to prevent something like this from ever happening to anyone else, and as reporters who believe in transparency, Ina Steiner said Tuesday in an email response to questions from the Associated Press. We hope that this case will serve as a deterrent. The settlement resolves more than 6 years of criminal and civil proceedings stemming from the harassment campaign. In their 2021 lawsuit filed in Boston federal court, the Steiners said that the company engaged in a conspiracy to intimidate, threaten to kill, torture, terrorize, stalk, and silence them in order to stifle their reporting on eBay. The Natick residents who report on the e-commerce industry in their newsletter said they were subjected to cyber stalking, death threats, and in-person surveillance by former eBay workers. Ina Steiner said the campaign began with threatening direct messages on social media before escalating into anonymous deliveries of live cockroaches and spiders, a funeral wreath, a bloody pig Halloween mask, and a book about surviving the death of a spouse. The employees also sent pornographic magazines with David Steiner's name to a neighbor's home and planned to install a GPS device on the couple's car. She said she did not initially know who was behind it or why. I could not conceive that a company I had been covering for the past 2 decades had tried to terrorize us into stopping our reporting, she said. When the lawsuit was filed, the company said the misconduct of these former employees was wrong, and it would do what is fair and appropriate to try to address what the Steiners went through. eBay reiterated its apology Tuesday, saying what the Steiners were subjected to by former employees in 2019 was wrong, reprehensible, and should never have happened. The company also acknowledged the unprofessional tone in internal communications by former CEO Devin Wenig, former Chief Communications Officer Steve Weimer, and former Senior Vice President Wendy Jones. The company said the conduct is not representative of eBay's culture and said it has since changed leadership and strengthened its policies, procedures, and ethics training. In 2020, federal prosecutors charged 7 former eBay employees alleging they carried out a coordinated harassment campaign against the couple after being angered by coverage in the couple's online newsletter. Most of the defendants pleaded guilty to charges, including conspiracy and cyber stalking, and were later sentenced to prison terms or home confinement. In 2024, eBay agreed to pay a $3 million criminal penalty under a deferred prosecution agreement with federal authorities. Under the settlement, the Steiners will receive $48.7 million in compensation, including $46.15 million from eBay, $2 million from former CEO Wenig, $500,000 from former Executive Jones, and $50,000 from former Executive Weimer. The company will fund $6 million in charitable contributions to various nonprofit organizations, with Wenning contributing an additional $1 million to a charity dedicated to protecting First Amendment rights in Ina Steiner's name. In a statement, Steiner's attorney Christopher Murphy cited the recovery amount, personal payments by former executives, a commitment for $7 million to go to the nonprofits, and the absence of a confidentiality provision in a system where wrongdoers too often hide their misdeeds by dangling compensation in front of those they victimized and trading that compensation for confidentiality or NDA. Protecting journalists and publishers are deterring corporate misconduct where goals from the beginning, he said. We believe this resolution sends a clear message that corporations and their executives cannot engage in this type of misconduct without facing significant consequences, said Murphy of Massachusetts-based Scully Murphy Law. Ina Steiner said she and her husband hoped that some good will come out of this painful, life-changing experience. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, Lawrence Summer basketball tourney celebrates 10 years, dunks for a decade. In Lawrence, a community basketball tournament designed to promote teamwork, discipline, and connection with friends celebrated its 10th anniversary with hundreds of kids attending. For the past decade, State Rep Frank Moran has hosted a youth basketball tournament with Lawrence Police. On Saturday, with the Howard Playset as its backdrop, kids played hoop, were awarded scholarships, enjoyed ice cream, and built camaraderie. The event, launched in 2016, is held every summer in coordination with the Lawrence Police Department, Suenos Basketball, and a group of dedicated volunteers from across the city. This tournament demonstrates how sports and teamwork can build connection, identity, and integrity in a community, said Moran. I am grateful to everyone who participated in this event, especially the many volunteers who took time out of their summer to bring this tournament to life. Watching the city of Lawrence come together to support the players is the highlight of my year, he said. This year's recipients of scholarships from the Felix A. Moran Foundation, created in honor of Moran's late brother, were announced. They are Randy Guzman, Yasleen Peralta, and Luz del Alba Diaz, all of whom will attend college this fall to further their academic careers. LPD officers served as tournament referees and volunteers, donated food and ice cream, and raffled off bikes to the youths in attendance. The Lawrence Police Department welcomes any opportunity to engage with our young people, especially through activities that bring the community together, said Lieutenant Joseph J. Cerullo. LPD has gotten a firsthand experience of the positive impact this tournament has had on our city, and our officers are, as always, thrilled to once again take part in the tradition, Cerullo said. This event has grown to be so much more than just a basketball tournament, said Martha Velez, the city's human service director. It is an annual celebration of the Lawrence community, reflective of the outpouring of dedication that goes toward uplifting our young people and ensuring they are given every opportunity to succeed, Velez said. Event sponsors include Dalton and Feingold, LLP, the City of Lawrence, Lawrence Recreation Department, New Balance, Ceramed Properties, Commonwealth Motors, Greater Lawrence Family Health Center, Shaw's and Star Market, Lawrence Vietnam Memorial Committee, Cibao Atlantico, Almanzar Insurance, Gemline, and DJ Nero. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have two short ones. First, e-scooter rider is hospitalized after crash. Out of Lowell, police said one person was hospitalized Sunday after crashing an electric scooter at the intersection of Market and Dutton Streets. Lowell Police Deputy Superintendent Mark LeBanc told The Sun in a message Monday evening that officers responded to the intersection shortly after 1:45 p.m. Sunday for reports of a motor vehicle crash. Upon arrival, officers determined that an electric scooter had struck the rear of a motor vehicle turning from Dutton Street onto Market Street. The operator of the electric scooter sustained non-life-threatening injuries and was transported to a local hospital for treatment, said LeBlanc. LeBlanc said those inside the vehicle that was struck by the scooter were unharmed. The individual who was riding the electrical scooter was not identified by police. Photos circulating on social media show the aftermath of the crash, with the visibly damaged electric scooter laying in the intersection surrounded by police tape, alongside a backpack, a pair of blue and black sandals, and what appears to be a spatter of blood. Okay, next article. Riverbend names new CEO. Out of Lowell, local substance recovery agency Riverbend has named a new leader as of Monday, with Evan Boyack named as the new CEO after former CEO Michael Reinke stepped down to serve as an Episcopal priest in Connecticut. Boyack has been with the Riverbend for 3 years, first as the organization's chief people officer, and then for the last year as the chief operating officer. Reinke will remain on for a 2-week transitional period, after which Boyack will take the top role. Riverbend Board of Directors Chair Louise Griffin said in a statement Tuesday that Boyack has demonstrated exceptional leadership, integrity, and commitment to Riverbend's mission. His understanding of our organization, our employees, and the communities we serve made him the clear choice to lead Riverbend into its next chapter, said Griffin. The board is confident in his vision and ability to continue building on the strong foundation that has been established. Boyack's new position comes as Riverbend moves into the second year of its 5-year strategic plan, which is aimed at expanding access to addiction services while making Riverbend's program more sustainable in the long term. Boyack said he's honored to have the opportunity to lead Riverbend. Over the past 3 years, I have seen firsthand the incredible dedication of our employees and the life-changing impact they make every day, said Boyack. Together, we will continue expanding access to compassionate, evidence-based care while strengthening our commitment to the people and communities we serve. Reinick has served in the CEO role at Riverbend since 2023. He was the executive director of the Nashua Soup Kitchen when he was selected for the role upon the retirement of former CEO Bill Garr, who served in the role for 10 years. As an agency, Riverbend serves 1,200 people dealing with a variety of substance abuse disorders annually in Massachusetts, with an annual budget of $18.5 million to fund its community-based services, residential programs, community outreach, and recovery support services. When Reinke joined in 2023, the budget for Riverbend's services was $10 million, which itself was a significant increase from the $1 million annual budget Garr had when he was named CEO in 2013. The organization was founded in 1971 under the name Lowell House Incorporated, a title it carried until it was changed to Riverbend during Reinke's tenure in 2024. The change in name was meant to reflect the expansion of the agency had undergone in the more than 5 decades since it was founded, from serving only the city of Lowell to now serving communities up and down the Merrimack River, including Tewksbury, Methuen, Haverhill, Reading, and Lawrence. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, North Andover, congressional hopefuls square off in debate. The recent Haverhill sewer main break that spilled 8 million gallons of untreated sewage into the Merrimack River and closed beaches was one of the many issues raised Tuesday night in a 6th congressional district primary debate at the North Andover Historical Society's Warden Theater. 6 Democratic candidates, along with Republican Micah Jones, are running to fill U.S. Rep. Seth Moulton's seat after he chose to challenge Senator Ed Markey in the state Democratic primary. The debate was hosted by the North Andover Democratic Town Committee ahead of the primary September 1. The state election is November 3. Democratic candidates Bethany Andres Beck, John Bexia, Jamie Belcito, Mariah Lancaster, and Tram Nguyen participated in the North Andover Forum. Dan Coe withdrew from the debate due to death in his family. The candidates were asked several questions focusing on money in politics, Israel, and reasserting congressional authority, among other topics. But one question centered on the recent Haverhill sewer main break that sent sewage into the Merrimack River, although the city had signed a consent decree with the Environmental Protection Agency to fix its sewers a decade ago. The candidates were asked if Democrats do not become the majority, how can they change the priorities of their colleagues to secure funding for essential infrastructure projects. Haverhill was used as an example. Part of the job of someone going to Congress is to find these funds and earmark them for our district, Bessia said. Bessia added that prioritization will ensure the state is not dealing with aging infrastructure, and talked about climate change and the environmental factors that led to the Haverhill spill. We need to go to Congress and fight for these projects and again prioritize it for this community, he said. We have the greatest coastline, the greatest beaches here, but it's not going to be that way if we don't act now. Lancaster touted bipartisanship and building a coalition when working as potentially a minority party. She said it isn't just blue states that care about their infrastructure, and there are different pieces of aging infrastructure throughout the country that need attention. There are people across the country that have pipe breaks, that have collapsing bridges, and that is where the role of a member of Congress is not just to sit on your hands when you're in the minority, Lancaster said. If you are in the minority, you do have to work with the majority, build the coalitions of people who are willing. Belcito said she has been fortunate to work with Congress for the past decade with her nonprofit and has seen issues go both ways with Republicans seeking help from Democrats when something needs to be fixed. She added that aging infrastructure is a decades-long problem not only in the 6th District, but others. She cited problems with the sewage treatment plant on Cape Ann and what might happen if that fails. You think that the Merrimack River was bad. Let's see both of them collapse at the same time, Belcito said. This is a lack of working on infrastructure, not just through the administration, not just looking at the bipartisan infrastructure. Nguyen highlighted how she has served as the chair of the House Committee on Climate Action and Sustainability and her experience working with climate change. She said she's met with residents and businesses in North Andover after recent devastating floods to see how they were being affected. Nguyen said she was able to put in one of her bills in a conference committee now to require testing for combined sewage overflows for rivers and water infrastructure. At the federal level, Nguyen said she wants to continue working on these types of issues. Andres Beck said earmarking money to build infrastructure and political horse trading are the reasons why Democrats do not get funding when they are not in the majority. Andres Beck said they have proposed an infrastructure bank that would provide ongoing grants for new infrastructure projects, and maintenance of current infrastructure. We should not be gambling on holding power forever to keep Massachusetts running, Andreas Beck said. That system is fundamentally broken. We need to present solutions to America that move us away from this broken two-party system and let America build again. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have the five-minute read out of Lowell. Bridgewell, a nonprofit social and human services organization serving northeastern Massachusetts, announced the appointment of Enid Keefe of Townsend, a clinical director of Bridgewell Counseling Services in Lowell. As a veteran licensed mental health clinician and with experience caring for the populations we serve in Lowell, Enid is equipped with the operational and clinical skills that make an exceptional director. President and CEO Christopher Tuttle said, Enid will enable us to better serve the greater Lowell community by increasing accessibility, ease, and enhance the experience of each client as they take control over their overall wellness and health. Keith, an English-speaking bilingual speaker, will lead clinical and administrative staff and ensure the provision of quality services to those served by the clinic. For more information, visit bridgewell.org. Out of Lowell again, enjoy a family fun evening at the Pawtucket Farm Wildlife Sanctuary on Thursday, July 30th, which is this Thursday, and August 6th, from 4 to 6 p.m., 1413 Varnum Road. Learn about nature, food, and farming through interactive theme station-based activities during these free summer nights programming sponsored by the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation. A block party celebration is scheduled for Saturday, August 22nd. For more information, visit lowellandtrust.org/summer-nights. Out of Lowell again, Alex Slimy Lambert of Drakett represents his 9th annual Cars and Cans food drive on Saturday, August 1st from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Cross Point, 900 Chelmsford Street. The event features a showcase of rare and exotic automobiles while helping to feed people around the region. Admission is 3 canned food items per vehicle, 1 can per spectator, or a cash donation. In 2025, Cars and Cans raised $11,392 and donated 1,972 pounds of food, all from the benefit of the Merrimack Valley Food Bank. Local supporters include Gervais Lincoln of Lowell, Gervais Auto Group, Team Mickey Ward Charities, Michael Conway Insurance, Coca-Cola Beverages Northeast, WCAP 980 Radio, Kazangian Towing, Charisma Incorporated, SchoolAnimation.com, Clean Restroom Rentals, Royal House Roast Beef, Pizza and Seafood of Drakett, J&J Heating and Air Conditioning, Kafua Management Company, LLC, Procyon, CRD Enterprises Incorporated, Mill City Enterprise, Mod Pro, Northeast Custom Apparel, Drakett Car Wash, Gateway Car Wash, First Chance Mobile, Pelham, New Hampshire, Girardi Transportation, DeRosa Properties, Brock's Farm, and Silk Flower Studio and Spa. Out of Billerica on Saturday, August 1st, which is this Saturday from 10 to noon, Marlies Henderson is seeking volunteers to help pull water chestnuts in a section of the Concord River. If left unchecked, these invasive plants form dense mats that choke out native plants, degrade water quality, and make it difficult to paddle, fish, and enjoy the river. Volunteers can bring their own gear or use Billerica Recreation canoes and gear, including gloves and baskets. A reminder will go out with the details 24 hours prior to the event. Excuse me. And lastly, out of Lowell again, A Taste of the Acre celebrates the cultural and culinary diversity of Lowell's Acre neighborhood. home to 31 food businesses serving cuisine from 14 different countries. The program aims to support these businesses by drawing new customers and collaborating with business owners to expand their reach with a series of food markets, walking tours, and community partnerships, marketing the neighborhood as a food destination. Upcoming tours include Saturday, August 1st at 1:30 p.m., Wednesday, August 12th at 5:30 p.m., and Saturday, August 22nd at 1:30 p.m. Private tours are also available. For more information, email Lizzie Bowe at tastetheacre@gmail.com. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune in Methuen, $2.5 million special education vote set for August 10. The city council will be asked to approve spending $2.5 million in city reserves to kickstart a new program for students with autism next month. If approved, staff in a limited number of classrooms will be joined by specialists this coming school year, embedded to help with teaching students and training employees. The program, designed with help from Constellations Behavioral Services, is aimed at allowing more kids previously educated out of district to stay among their peers and to save the district potentially millions in out-of-district tuition costs. The request comes after the city has already spent or is expected to spend millions in reserves both on normal operating costs, like snow and ice, and to supplement the school's budget. However, school officials and Mayor DJ Beauregard have argued the one-time expenditure will set the school up to save money for years to come. Outside specialists will be slowly phased out during the duration of the contract, officials said. Although most teachers come to the district with some special education experience, the training they have received is usually broadly focused, according to school committee member Lori Keegan. Alongside improving educators' abilities to help students with highly specific needs, the project is also aimed at ensuring consistency between classrooms. The council meeting was initially scheduled for this coming Monday, but was moved to August 10 so that Chief Administrative and Financial Officer Maggie Dupree would be available, Council Chair Neely Soto said. Dupree's presence is important due to the financial commitment councilors were being asked to approve, Soto said. The contractor was selected after a recent public bidding process. Constellations, the Stepping Stones group, was selected based on the strength of their proposal, extensive experience working with public school districts, and the comprehensive services outlined included in their proposal. Assistant Superintendent of Student Services Gina Bozek said in a memo to other officials, "I respectfully encourage the council to support this investment in our students, our families, and the future of Methuen Public Schools," committee member Alejandro Bays said in a statement recently. "It is an opportunity to address structural budget challenges while expanding high-quality, community-based educational opportunities for the students who deserve them most. The program is expected to begin either on the first day of school or early in the school year." Officials said the timing will depend on when the funding is approved and how quickly background checks on incoming Constellations staff can be completed. Committee members gave the proposal unanimous approval during a meeting last week. Bozek said the school would be keeping track of the effectiveness of the teaching model both through student data and staff development. During the meeting, member Mary Beth Donovan Grassi said keeping a constant eye on the program would be vital to its success. I know that we need it, Donovan Grassi said. It's still going to be a lot of work. You have to keep an eye on a lot of people coming into this building, our buildings, she said. There is a lot on the line right now. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, out of Drake It, work begins on capital spending plan for school buildings. Members of the school committee and the board of selectmen have started work on a 5-year capital spending plan for those school buildings expected to require significant repairs and renovations. The Joint Education Subcommittee, which consists of 2 members of each board, met July 22nd following the June defeat of a plan to replace the Joseph A. Campbell and Greenmont Avenue schools. The subcommittee consists of school committee chair Bob Shepard and first vice chair Rebecca Duda and selectmen Josh Taylor and Christy Wolander. The projected cost of the new school was $177 million, with $82 million coming to the town through the Massachusetts School Building Authority. That would have left about $95 million for the town to raise through a debt exclusion from the Proposition 2.5 limit on annual increases in the tax levy. When the MSBA evaluated Drake It School building's needs in 2023, it considered a repair and renovation alternative to a new construction, but approved the new school option. A repair and renovations at the time of that evaluation was estimated to cost $83 million. Shepard explained the Campbell Elementary School building requires critical repairs and code upgrades, estimated at more than $57.5 million, while Greenmont Elementary School requires approximately $23.75 million in needed improvements. Those local funding needs did not disappear with the recent vote. The MSBA decision essentially locked out any reimbursement for the repair and renovation options without restarting the multi-phase, multi-year approval process. While the door is not completely shut on building a new school, its viability rests with the town sending a satisfactory explanation for the failed vote to the MSBA by August 31st to receive a 120-day extension to the town's timeline for financial approval. Essentially, they've given us a grace period through August to work together to commit to making the appropriation, Shepard recently told The Sun. The Education Subcommittee is working from the 2023 repair and renovation option as it begins the capital planning effort. During a debate at public meeting on the proposed new school, opponents sometimes referred to maintenance interchangeably with capital expense, but they are accounted for differently in town budgets. Maintenance refers to spending that keeps current operations running. A capital expense refers to funds raised to upgrade and/or replace buildings, land, or equipment. Drake It was recognized by the MSBA for the excellent maintenance of its buildings, due to recently pointed out. That recognition resulted in some extra funds in the MSBA reimbursement offer. Highlights of what repairs and renovations are needed at the two schools were presented in the 2023 document. At the Campbell, they include replacement of the roof, window walls, boiler plant, HVAC system, and the electrical distribution system. The Campbell also has a number of makeshift classrooms that limit program and classroom offerings, including in special education, music instruction, and computer labs. At the Greenmont, 12 actual classrooms are used as 2 kindergartens, 2 first grade, 2 second grade, 2 third grade, 2 fourth grade, and 2 fifth grade. But 7 other classroom-sized spaces serve as space for special education, arts, music, English language learners, and library. Other non-classroom-sized rooms offer space for a second special education class, a special education office, a computer lab, a combined cafeteria, gymnasium, and auditorium. As the school department struggles with budget issues, the Greenmont situation is complicated by a proposal to close it in the next fiscal year. That would require mobile classrooms. When the 5-year capital campaign is complete, it should be included in the town's 5-year plan. But The town has had a capital planning committee only intermittently over the last several years with changes in town leadership. That omission is being worked on. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, Haverhill police officer promoted to sergeant. A near 16-year veteran of public service earned some new stripes earlier this week while surrounded by family and fellow officers. The Haverhill Police Department officially promoted Nicole Donnelly to the rank of sergeant during a swearing-in ceremony Tuesday morning at Haverhill City Hall. Family members, friends, and department heads filled the city council chambers to witness the ceremony. Donnelly was joined by Haverhill Police Chief Wayne Tracy, Deputy Chief Megan Pear, and Mayor Melinda Barrett as she took the oath of office. Donnelly's family members stood before her and helped attach her new sergeant's badge to her uniform. She was first dispatched to kick off her career in October 2010 as a parking enforcement officer. It wasn't until June 2012 that she would be appointed as a police officer. Throughout her career, she has consistently demonstrated professionalism, dedication, and a strong commitment to serving the Haverhill community, the Haverhill Police Department wrote. Over the years, Donnelly has served in a variety of assignments, including as a school resource officer, SRO, patrol shift officer, and as the sergeant of the split shift while on patrol. The department said her diverse experience, leadership, and unwavering work ethic has made her a respected member of the police force and a trusted leader among her peers. In addition to her duties, Donnelly has served as a board member of the Haverhill Police Relief Association since 2014, supporting other officers and their families. Her promotion was announced on the Haverhill Police Department's Facebook page, where many local figures offered congratulations. The department recognized the career milestone and said that they wish her success in her next chapter of leadership. Next, MBTA touts new pilot programs to reduce transit costs, State House reporter in Boston. Commuter rail users will get another 3 months of discounted passes under a raft of MBTA changes announced Tuesday, which include reduced bus fares and a new pilot program providing free public transportation to seniors who hang up their car keys. The plans, unveiled by Governor Maura Healey on Tuesday, call for extending a 50% discount for monthly commuter rail passes for September, October, and November, and the $1 weekend companion fare, allowing monthly pass holders to bring one companion on weekend trips for $1 each way. MBTA officials said the changes are aimed at making public transportation more affordable and accessible at a time when record gas prices are making it more expensive to drive. In remarks at the Belmont Center commuter rail station Tuesday, Healy said the changes will put money back in people's pockets while giving more riders the flexibility they need to get to work, school, and everywhere in between. Interim Transportation Secretary and MBTA General Manager Philip Eng said the discounted commuter rail pass program has delivered strong results and pointed to a 50% increase in ridership on Fridays in June compared with May. He said T riders took more than 6,200 companion trips during the first six weekends of the program, and T officials want to keep the momentum going by extending the program. Affordability and ease of use are two things that move people towards utilizing public transportation, Eng said. It is my hope for more people to get on board and to enjoy the transportation possibilities that the MBTA can offer through its network. But the transit agency also rolled out several new pilot programs Tuesday, including a program that offers free fares to residents age 75 and older who have turned in their driver's license for a Massachusetts ID card. The program, which will be unveiled this fall, will include service on the bus, subway, ferry, and commuter rail. T officials also plan to roll out a pilot project this fall, eliminating higher express bus fares, which they estimate would save a rider who uses the express bus to commute nearly $500 over the six-month pilot project. Currently, seven bus routes in Boston charge higher rates, $4.25 for a full fare and $2.10 reduced for express bus service. The plan would eliminate the higher premium rates and charge only local bus fare, or $1.70 for full fare and 85 cents reduced for MBTA buses. Another pilot program will expand a two-hour unlimited transfers pilot, allowing riders to only pay the highest fare incurred during a two-hour window when taking subway, bus, or ferry trips. Currently, subway and bus riders can transfer only twice in a two-hour time window and must pay the cost of the highest price service.
You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week.
We are back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that helps us broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, Lindsey Graham eulogized as an American original. It's an interesting title. Let's see what that's all about. Out of Washington, D.C., Senator Lindsey Graham, the son of pool hall owners who rose to become one of his generation's more affluent U.S. politicians at home and abroad, was eulogized, I don't know why I'm having such a hard time with that word, today as a true American original during memorial services in Washington. Graham's flag-draped casket arrived for a tribute at the U.S. Capitol, where the Republican served for more than 30 years as an INDEFATIGABLE. Anyway, dealmaker, who talked and laughed and badgered his colleagues into action. Later, President Donald Trump joined foreign leaders for a funeral at Washington National Cathedral, a testament to Graham's stature on the global stage. Trump called Graham a giant of the United States Senate, a true American original who left us much too soon. In mostly prepared remarks, Trump described his one-time presidential rival turned ally as the first person to make you laugh and one of the last people that you've really ever wanted to fight. Trump told the story of how he had publicly disclosed Graham's cell phone number on the campaign trail, reciting the number in the cathedral, but said the senator had last laugh because Lindsey did not stop calling me for the next 10 years. Among those gathered were Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, leaders of two countries fighting separate wars, a nod to Graham's role as a foremost believer in the power of the U.S. and its military to intervene in the world's problems. Fox News' Sean Hannity, in his remarks, said Graham would have been moved that they both made the long journeys to attend. Trump's cabinet officials, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and current and former senators and lawmakers joined in the pews, as did Graham's sister, now Senator Darlene Graham, who was appointed by the state's governor to fill the remainder of her brother's term. It was the start of 2 days of service, with burial Wednesday in Graham's home state of South Carolina. Joint Base Charleston will be renamed in his honor, as an Air Force official said. Graham died suddenly on July 11th at his home in Washington of a likely aortic tear, according to the preliminary findings. He had just returned from a whirlwind trip to a NATO summit in Turkey, where he celebrated his birthday and a visit to Ukraine. He was 71. During the morning services in the Capitol Rotunda, Vice President J.D. Vance described Graham as a man of swashbuckling stature, who swashbuckled into the Senate with his suit jacket open and was impossible not to like. Lindsey was a towering figure, Senator Majority Leader John Thune said, choking back tears during his remarks. First elected to Congress in the 1994 Republican revolt that swept the GOP to power, Graham was part of a new era of conservatives to take their seats in the House, and among the first Republicans from his southern state since Reconstruction. He quickly rose to prominence as manager in Democratic Bill Clinton's presidential impeachment, and he was elected to the Senate in the 2002 election. There, he formed an alliance with Senator John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, and Senator Joe Lieberman, an independent from Connecticut, in what would become the Three Amigos, globetrotting the world focused on national security issues. Vance recalled how he argued with Graham over the senator's staunch support for aid to the Ukraine, which has divided the GOP, but praised his legacy, saying Kavanaugh would not be on the Supreme Court were it not for Graham's fierce advocacy during the confirmation hearings. For decades, Graham had been the center of the action, a member of virtually every bipartisan gang in Congress, with a relentless ability to adapt to political realities, particularly when it came to Trump. One by one, many of Graham's colleagues said their goodbyes in the rotunda. Senator Katie Britt, Republican from Alaska, placed both hands on his casket and then placed her hand on her heart. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat from Illinois, saluted from her wheelchair. Former Senator Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, bowed and delivered a brief kiss on, and Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana, gave a fist bump. Perhaps nowhere was Graham's political dexterity on display more as when he navigated his on-again, off-again relationship with Trump. Graham had denounced Trump as a unit for office, as unfit for office during the 2016 presidential campaign, but over time he had become what colleagues called the Trump whisperer, someone even world leaders relied on to understand the president. Days before his death, Graham had won Trump's support for a long-fought bipartisan proposal to impose sanctions on Russia over the war in the Ukraine, in what would be one of the strongest U.S. efforts to hamper Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to prolong the conflict. Senators were scheduled to take a first procedural vote Tuesday evening on the sanctions package in Graham's honor. Zelensky is expected to be on hand and meeting with senators in the evening. At the Washington Cathedral, a roster of socially conservative and anti-abortion leaders gave readings, including Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, Marjorie Jones Deffenfelser of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, and Reverend William Franklin Graham III. When Hannity said how important Darlene Graham and her family had been to the Senate, she put her hand over her heart in response. Lindsey Graham never married, but the Air Force veteran helped support his younger sister after both of his parents died while he was at college and then starting law school. He became the guardian for Darlene, who was then 13, and he later in life often extolled the benefits of Social Security that helped keep them financially afloat. Darlene Graham is now running in a potentially crowded primary field for the fall election. The filing period for the special primary election closes Tuesday with voting set for August 11th. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, state acquires new firefighter training trailer in Stowe. The Massachusetts Department of Fire Services announced the expansion of firefighter survival training at the Massachusetts Firefighting Academy Monday with the addition of a new mobile, self-contained breathing apparatus training maze. The new training system will increase access to realistic, hands-on instruction for recruit and veteran municipal firefighters across the Commonwealth. One of DFS's most important responsibilities is ensuring firefighters across Massachusetts have access to the highest quality training possible. Public Safety and Security Secretary Gina Kwan said, "That means continually investing in modern equipment and training environments that reflect the dangerous and unpredictable conditions firefighters face in the field. Better training builds more confident, better prepared firefighters, and better prepared firefighters help make communities across Massachusetts safer." The new mobile training maze expands the MFA's ability to deliver firefighter survival training both on campus and directly to local fire departments. Combined with the Academy's existing mobile training resources, it will increase access to realistic, hands-on SCBA training for recruits and experienced firefighters alike. The unit also replaces the Academy's original Stowe-based SCBA maze, ensuring this critical training remains available for years to come. This year, DFS marks 30 years of training Massachusetts firefighters through the MFA. Since 1996, the Academy has prepared thousands of firefighters for the challenges of the job while continually evolving its training programs to reflect new technologies, emerging hazards, and best practices. The addition of the new mobile SCBA training maze builds on that legacy by giving more firefighters the opportunity to train in realistic, high-pressure environments that build the skills and confidence they need to respond safely and effectively when lives are on the line. The SCBA training maze is one of our most frequently requested training tools, said State Fire Marshal John M. Devine. This new mobile unit allows us to deliver critical survival training to more firefighters in more communities while strengthening the MFA's ability to prepare recruits and veteran firefighters for the dangerous and unpredictable conditions they face. Providing firefighters with realistic training is one of the best investments we can make in their safety and the safety of the communities they serve. Inside the maze, firefighters navigate dark, confined, and unfamiliar environments while wearing full turnout gear and SCBA. The training is designed to build confidence under stress, improve air management, and reinforce the skills firefighters rely on during searches, rescues, and self-extrication. DFS invested approximately $500,000 in the new training system, supported in large part by a $435,000 FEMA Assistance to Firefighters grant. The investment reflects DFS's continued commitment to providing firefighters across Massachusetts with access to realistic state-of-the-art training. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have some AP articles. So out of the Middle East, U.S. says it thwarted an Iranian missile attack. Washington, D.C., American and Saudi forces struck sites used by Iranian-backed militia in Iraq to carry out attacks in recent days, the U.S. military said Tuesday. U.S. and Saudi firefighters, aircraft struck multiple terrorist logistics and weapon sites across eastern Iraq in a strong response to over 30 IRGC-directed aerial drone attacks in the last 72 hours. U.S. Central Command said in a statement using an acronym for Iran's Parliamentary Revolutionary Guard. It said the Revolutionary Guard and its terrorist proxies must cease these attacks to avoid further U.S. military response. Saudi Arabia said earlier Tuesday that it for a second day shot down drones fired by Iran-backed militias in Iraq, which had attempted to target petroleum facilities in the nation's eastern region. Iraqi Prime Minister Ali al-Zayed ordered security agencies to investigate after the Saudis alleged a similar attack on Monday. The U.S. military said it knocked down an Iranian ballistic missile attack against American forces in the Middle East on Tuesday, shattering a brief pause in the fighting as mediators tried to get both sides back to negotiations. All Iranian missiles were successfully intercepted, the U.S. Central Command said, adding the U.S. forces remain vigilant and at a high state of readiness. The United States and Iran had experienced a period of calm during which neither announced attacks for days following weeks of escalation over the strategic Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf waterway, a narrow choke point through which 20% of the world's oil normally flows. There was no immediate comment from Tehran on the U.S. military statement or the strikes. The resumption of fighting comes at the end of a month packed with multiple pressure points on U.S. President Donald Trump over the war. In recent weeks, four U.S. troops died during the fighting. While the Pentagon asked an increasingly skeptical Congress for money to cover the conflict's ballooning costs. High gas prices from the continued closure of the Strait of Hormuz are contributing to fears that Republicans are vulnerable in November's midterm elections. The House narrowly passed a resolution to halt U.S. military action in Iran last week, sending another warning to Trump that reflects the war's unpopularity with many Americans. Trump has repeatedly retreated from threats to knock out bridges, power plants, and other infrastructure, but he told Fox News Channel in an interview earlier Tuesday that Iran knows he'll finish the job, in quotes, if its leaders don't make a deal to end the war. Iran had effectively closed the strait when the war began by firing at freighters and tankers off its coast or threatening them. Following the signing of an interim ceasefire deal in June, a battle for control over the strait erupted. Iran demanded that ships use a route near its coastline and said it could potentially charge fees. Ships were increasingly navigating a southern route along the coast of Oman under a U.S. overwatch operation when Iran attacked some vessels. Saudi Arabia said earlier on Tuesday that it shot down drones fired by Iranian-backed militia in Iraq for a second day, while Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen claimed to have forced a Saudi oil tanker to turn around as part of their self-styled blockage of the kingdom. The kingdom's defense ministry said in a statement that air defenses intercepted and destroyed several drones that had attempted to target petroleum facilities in the nation's eastern region. It said the attacks were once again launched from Iraqi territory and carried out by Iranian-affiliated terrorist militias. Iraq Prime Minister Ali al-Zayed ordered security agencies to investigate after the Saudis alleged a similar attack on Monday. The Iraqi military said in a statement that Iraq is committed to preventing Iraqi territory from being used as a route or launching point for any attack targeting brotherly or friendly countries. The Iraqi militias have denied any role in the drone attacks. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella group of Iran-backed army groups, called the Saudis' claim fabrications and implied that Monday's attacks were carried out by the Houthis, who had themselves claimed to have attacked Saudi oil facilities. Meanwhile, the Houthis claimed to have fired missiles at the Saudi oil tanker NCC Ghazal, forcing it to turn back. Last week, they announced a blockade of Saudi shipping, putting another key Middle Eastern waterway through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, leading to the Red Sea, at risk. The United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center said a tanker reportedly hearing explosions while traveling in the southern Red Sea. It did not name the tanker, but did say the crew and vessel were safe. Rebels fired on at least one Saudi tanker in the Red Sea last week. Iran and the U.S. paused their fighting over the weekend, though tensions remain high, as officials said mediators achieved progress in getting the two sides back to negotiations. Iran said early Tuesday that U.S. strikes during an earlier period of escalation destroyed an airport and a marine control tower and caused damage to 12 bridges and 2 tunnels, among other infrastructure. Trump values Netanyahu. Iran's surprise strikes came as Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Washington, and Trump, the U.S. and Israel, launched the war against Iran on February 28th, but Israel has been notably absent from the recent fighting with the Islamic Republic. Netanyahu said he had an excellent meeting with Trump at the White House, their first sit-down since launching the war, which offered Netanyahu a chance to smooth out strains in their relationship. The closed-door meeting lasted nearly an hour and a half and was positive and productive, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said. The White House did not immediately offer more details. It comes as both leaders face growing pressure at home. Netanyahu is up for re-election and is embattled in part because of his deteriorating relationship with Trump. Trump is under pressure to end an unpopular war that has wreaked economic havoc on driven prices higher ahead of midterm elections this November. Concerns over U.S. munitions stockpile. The U.S. ability to intercept Iran's incoming strikes has become an increasingly salient issue as lawmakers, members of the military, and experts raise concerns over the nation's diminishing stockpiles of missile interceptors. Sean Purnell, the Pentagon's chief spokesperson, pushed back on those concerns, saying in a statement that the U.S. military has everything it needs to execute at the time and place of the president's choosing. The Pentagon also said that a new separate category was created in its official casualty tally for those killed and wounded in the U.S.-Iran fighting because of the Operation Epic Fury, the military's official name for combat operations in Iran had concluded earlier. The Defense Casualty Analysis System has removed the 4 soldiers killed and dozens of troops wounded in the latest exchange of fire from its Iran war tally and placed them in a new category called Overseas Operations. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, AAA average mass gas price jumps 10 cents in Westwood. Pump prices across the state are higher after another week of climbing oil prices in response to heightened tensions between the United States and Iran, according to AAA. On Monday, the average gas price is up 10 cents from last week, $4.03, averaging $4.13 per gallon. The price is 18 cents higher than a month ago, $3.95. and $1.09 higher than this day last year, $3.04. Massachusetts' average gas price is 2 cents higher than the national average. AAA Northeast July 27 survey of fuel prices found the current national average is up 11 cents from last week, $4, averaging $4.11 per gallon. Monday's national average price is 24 cents higher than a month ago, $3.87, and 97 cents higher than this day last year, at $3.14. As of Monday, Indiana and Mississippi had the lowest prices in the nation at $3.49 and $3.66, respectively. California and Hawaii hold the highest prices in the nation this week at $5.64 and $5.42, respectively. Massachusetts holds the 22nd place on the list of highest gas prices in the nation. Pump prices have been a roller coaster this summer as geopolitical tensions shift between escalation and de-escalation, says Mark Shildrop, senior spokesperson for AAA Northeast. Oil and gas markets are likely to remain unsettled as long as the situation in the Middle East remains volatile. Crude prices finished about $8.50 a barrel higher last week when trading ended on Friday, as fighting continued across the Middle East for a second week. Crude prices climbed roughly $20 a barrel over the past 2 weeks since the unraveling of the ceasefire agreement reached in mid-June, and retail gasoline prices have followed suit, swelling solidly above $4 a gallon on average across the Northeast. Pump prices could stabilize in the coming days, however, as both crude and wholesale gasoline prices begin this week sharply lower after both the U.S. and Iran announced a pause in attacks on Sunday. In overnight trading, U.S. crude fell more than $6 and Brent crude declined more than $7 a barrel as markets reacted to the news. Despite the sell-off ahead of market opening on Monday, crude prices remained about $14 higher than they were a month ago. Next, Merrimack Valley in a minute. Temple Emmanuel hosts summer outing in Andover. Mark the calendar for the Temple Emmanuel summer outing from 11:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. August 3 at Indian Ridge Country Club, 73 Lovejoy Road. The event will feature a golf tournament, pickleball tournament, mahjong, round robin, tennis, swimming, family fun, dinner, and a silent auction. Registration and lunch kick off at 11:30 a.m., followed by beginner pickleball and a shotgun start at 1 p.m. Tennis, pickleball, and the pool open at 1 p.m. as well. The mahjong tournament will start at 3 p.m., while dinner, reception, and silent auction launch at 6:30 p.m. All are welcome to join the community for the festivities. Folks coming for dinner only pay $80, while golf foursomes pay $1,000, which includes lunch, dinner, a cart, driving range, and putting green access. Single golfers may also pay $250 to participate. Go to facebook.com/Temple Emmanuel Andover MA to learn more or register. Bruins mascot celebrates summer reading in Andover. The Boston Bruins have teamed up with libraries across the state to encourage kids and teens to keep reading over the summer. Memorial Hall Library, 2N Main Street, is one of the 12 public libraries selected to receive a special summer reading visit from Bruins mascot Blades at 1 p.m. August 13. Blades will join readers for a story, some game day fun and crafts. Participants can design and make their own Bruins fan button, take pictures at the ice rink photo station, and more. A special library poster featuring Bruins player Jeremy Swayman will also be available. Registration is required and can be done online at mhl.org or by calling 978 623-8440. The Boston Bruins have teamed up with the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, MBLC, since 2009 for the annual Summer Library Program, When You Read, You Score. Since then, millions of kids, teens, and adults have participated in it. The statewide Summer Library Program is sponsored by Memorial Hall Library, the Friends of Memorial Hall Library, the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, the Massachusetts Library System, and the Boston Bruins. Labor Day Concert at Winnikenny Castle in Haverhill. Join the city of Haverhill for an afternoon of live music and food trucks from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, September 6th at Winnikenny Castle, 78 Castle Road. The city will close out its season of 250th programming with a Labor Day concert. Folks can bring friends, pack lawn chairs, and swing by the castle for a free, family-friendly event. Stay tuned for a lineup of bands and food trucks. Contact the Haverhill Mayor's Office at 978-374-2300 for more information. Last article. Healey urges Senate to extend Haitian TPS. State House reporter, Boston. Governor Maura Healey is calling the U.S. Senate to grant a last-minute extension to tens of thousands of Haitian immigrants facing deportation with temporary immigration protections now expired. A proposal filed last week by Democratic U.S. Senator Ed Markey would provide another extension to the Temporary Protected Status Program for more than 350,000 Haitians immigrants and put them on a path towards citizenship. The bill, however, was blocked by Republicans. In a letter to Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Healey urged lawmakers to take up the Senate bill that was previously approved by the U.S. House of Representatives and warned of catastrophic humanitarian and economic impacts if a TPS extension isn't granted. Healey said Haitian TPS holders are essential contributors to our state's workforce, filling roles that are vital to our economic stability and growth. She said their loss could have a crippling effect on the state healthcare system. Across industries from healthcare and long-term care to transportation, hospitality, and construction, these workers help keep our economy running. Healey, a first-term Democrat, wrote, "The sudden loss of their legal status and work authorization would be devastating for our state. Massachusetts stands to lose an estimated 2,000 healthcare workers because of the Supreme Court's recent decision allowing the Trump administration to end the program. The loss of workers comes as the state and nation face persistent workforce shortages," she said. "Stripping TPS holders of their ability to work would significantly worsen staffing shortages, increase healthcare costs, reduce access to care, and place additional strain on an already stressed healthcare system," Healey wrote. Haiti's TPS designation was first granted in 2010 after a devastating earthquake and has been extended amid political instability in the country. There are about 350,000 Haitians living in the U.S. under the TPS program, and Boston is home to about 45,000, one of the largest populations of Haitians in the country. Last year, then Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem issued an order reversing a move by then President Joe Biden in 2024 to extend TPS for Haiti through this February. Massachusetts is one of several states that sued to block the TPS expiration. In February, U.S. District Judge Anna C. Reyes blocked the move and accused Noem of trying to turn legal immigrants into illegal immigrants to ramp up mass deportation efforts. The ruling was upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals, but the Trump administration petitioned the Supreme Court to decide the issue of whether continued extension of the program is legal. Last month, the High Court's conservative majority ruled that the administration can end TPS for Haiti and Syria while leaving in place lower court orders that delayed the terminations until July 27. TPS was created as part of the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act and grants migrants work authorization and protection from deportation if their country of origin is deemed unsafe due to armed conflict, natural disaster, or extraordinary and temporary conditions. The Trump administration argues that TPS has been exploited and abused to allow more immigrants into the U.S. illegally and has accused the former Biden administration of attempting to tie its hands by extending Haiti's protected status by 18 months. Last week, the Department of Homeland Security announced that those with an expiring TPS designation have one last opportunity to accept free tickets out of the country. For those with an expiring TPS designation, these final days provide one last opportunity to accept $2,600 and a free flight home. James Percival, DHS's general counsel, posted on social media, "We strongly suggest you take advantage of this generous offer." Back to you, Diane.
Okay, more from the Associated Press. Out of Georgia, teen gets life without parole for killing four at high school. A judge on Tuesday sentenced a teenager who killed two students and two teachers in a shooting at Alpalachee High School in Georgia to serve life in prison without the possibility of parole, calling his crimes deliberate and contempted evil. Colt Gray, 16, had pleaded guilty Friday to 55 counts, including murder, in the September 4th, 2024 shooting at the school about 45 miles northeast of Atlanta. Barrow County Superior Court Judge Nicholas Prim handed down the sentence after hearing from family members of those killed and victims, as well as investigators, Gray's grandmother, and a forensic psychologist who had evaluated Gray. Murder carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison in Georgia, so the only decision Barrow County Superior Court Judge Nicholas Prim had to make was whether Gray should ever be eligible for parole. He decided the teen should never be allowed out. "You do not seem to be tormented by what you did. You seem to relish following in the footsteps of the murderers you idolize. You weren't racked with guilt. You're proud of yourself," Prim said. "We've seen no evidence he has any ability to develop a conscience or any ability to ever fully value human life," District Attorney Brad Smith had said during his closing arguments, insisting that Gray cannot be in society. Defense Attorney William Shorten Allen told the judge his client was not irretrievably broken. Allowing him the possibility of parole would give him an opportunity of hope, Allen said, adding that a lack of hope takes away the ability for him to change. "This is not a happy day. This is a relief day, I would say," Smith told reporters after the sentencing, adding that he hoped his team had done honor to the victims and their loved ones. Teacher Richard Ricky Aspinall, 39, and Christina Urami, 53, and students Mason Schershorn and Christian Anglo, both 14, died in the shooting. Another teacher and 8 more students were wounded, 7 of them hit by gunfire. Victims of the shooting and family members of those killed conveyed their anger and grief to Prim on Friday, almost all of them asking him not to allow the possibility of parole. Shaina Aspinwall, the wife of math teacher and football coach Richard Aspinwall, described a life sentence of grief and trauma for those left behind. Investigators testified during the 3-day sentencing hearing that Gray idolized mass shooters, talking about them online with other members of the true crime community, a group of young people online who are fascinated with such attacks. Gray had chatted online about gaining notoriety through a school shooting. Prosecutors played recordings of a phone conversation Gray had with his mother, Marcy Gray, from a youth detention center in the months after the shooting. During those calls, he directed his mother to look up what people were saying about him online. He was excited when she described fan art drawings depicting him or comments people made about him and the attention he was getting online. Gray had the mental wherewithal to mimic details of other mass killings on the day of the shooting, Smith said. He placed those Easter eggs, anticipating that they would be mentioned in court one day and would perpetuate his fame, the prosecutor said. The shooting was not the culmination of the plan. The shooting was just one of the steps of the plan. The plan was ultimate and lifelong fame inside of the TCC, Smith said, referring to the true crime community. Gray's grandmother says he needed help. Coke got less stability than he needed, which made him even more vulnerable. Allen, the defense attorney, argued. He said his client got wrapped up in an online community where he found the acceptance he craved but wasn't getting at home. Gray's maternal grandmother, Debbie Paula Humus, testified that the teen had a troubled childhood and that his parents failed him. Her grandson had grown highly agitated and aggressive in the weeks before the shooting, she said, adding that she had urged his parents to get him some help, but they didn't follow through. I tried to help Colt because nobody else was helping him, she said. Paul Humus said she visits her grandson once a week at a youth detention center and that he has improved enormously with treatment and medication. She said her grandson has been doing a lot of reading and wants to study to get a GED diploma. I'd like to see him have a chance at some point to prove himself, she said. Gray was put in foster care while in detention because his father was in prison and there were concerns about his mother's contact with him. Candace Broche, director of the State Division of Family and Children's Services and commissioner of the Georgia Department of Human Services, managed his case. Broche testified that Gray appeared to show improvement. After Marcy Gray was barred from speaking with her son by a July 2025 no-contact order and he started taking medication, staff at the Youth Detention Center said he changed him essentially into a different child. The judge acknowledged that Gray had been failed by his parents, his extended family, and to a certain extent, society, but that failure does not absolve you from who you chose to idolize, worship, and become, Prim told Gray. Right, next article. Let's see. Netanyahu praises first meeting with Trump since launching war. Out of Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had an excellent meeting with President Donald Trump at the White House on Tuesday, their first sit-down since launching a joint war against Iran that offered Netanyahu a chance to smooth out strains in their relationship. The closed-door meeting lasted nearly an hour and a half and was positive and productive, White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said. The White House did not immediately offer more details. It comes as both leaders face growing pressures at home. Netanyahu is up for re-election and is embattled in part of his deteriorating relationship with Trump. Trump is under pressure to end an unpopular war that raised economic havoc and driven prices higher ahead of midterm elections this November. Did I read this already?
I don't know.
I don't know either. It sounds like I don't think so. I think I read the Iranian war thing, and there's just
oh yes, similar. If it's from the Associated Press,
yeah,
then most likely.
Yeah, similar quotes.
Yes.
Sorry, that was like a deja vu thing. Okay. It comes as both leaders face growing pressure at home. Netanyahu is up for re-election and is embattled in part because of its deteriorating relationship with Trump. Trump is under pressure because he's more unpopular over the economy, basically. Despite signs of tension between the two ahead of the meeting, Netanyahu was effusive afterward in a post on Instagram, noting that the meeting included Trump's entire senior team. Vice President J.D. Vance, who has had critical words for Israel and in June warned Israeli officials that Trump was their only friend among world leaders, was among those in the meeting. When I say excellent, I don't mean it in a superficial way, Netanyahu said in Hebrew, a conversation with full partnership, with mutual support, with an understanding of the common goal of assuring that Iran does not have nuclear weapons and other goals as well. One of the best conversations I have had with the President of the United States, our friend Donald Trump. Netanyahu later joined Vance and Trump at a funeral for Senator Lindsey Graham, where the Israeli leader was seen speaking to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, who met with Trump earlier in the day. Trump revealed some tension with Netanyahu ahead of their meeting, complaining about reports that the Israeli leader plans to discuss intelligence on Iranian activities at Pickaxe Mountain, a potential nuclear site the U.S. president has threatened repeatedly to bomb. I know exactly what's going on at Pickaxe, Trump told Fox and Friends. He insisted that whatever Iran is doing is not a big problem and that Bibi's telling me that because he wants me to stay involved. Why do you have to announce to the world, Trump added, flashing his frustration with his ally. Trump has had a hot and cold history with Netanyahu over the years, but upon his return to the White House last year, their alliance seemed stronger than ever. When they started the war together in February, it was with a united front touting their respective militaries as acting in lockstep to take out Iran's leadership and pave the way for a government more friendly to the West. But as Iran fought back, sending drones and missiles slamming into U.S. bases on high rises in the cities in the Gulf and shocking off the Strait of Hormuz, Trump came under immense pressure both at home and by allies in the region to end the conflict. Since then, Netanyahu wanted to continue the fighting in Iran and against its ally Hezbollah in Lebanon has been sidelined as Trump sought a deal with Tehran. Disagreements with Trump and Vance have burst into the open over the war in Iran and more. The Americans are making it clear to the Israelis they are the ones who are running the war, Israeli journalist and political analyst Amit Sigal wrote Monday in the daily newspaper Israel Hayom. It's clear to everyone that Israel has been put in the back seat. Netanyahu planned to share with Trump Israeli intelligence on Tehran's nuclear program, according to a person familiar with Netanyahu's visit, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak to the media. Netanyahu said Sunday that he hoped to sit down with Trump to hear what he has in his mind for Iran, because I think in many ways it's his indecision on how to move forward, Netanyahu told Maria Bartiromo on Fox News Channel's Sunday Morning Futures. If he can do so without returning to intense military fighting, that's fine. Why not? But one way or the other, they have to end their nuclear program, he said of Iran. The two leaders also had planned to discuss the framework agreement the U.S. and Israeli signed with Lebanon over the Israel-Hezbollah war and the expansion of Abraham Accords, according to the White House official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to preview the meeting. Steps to allow other forces in Gaza and in Lebanon. Netanyahu also needs to persuade Trump that he won't play spoiler to the U.S. diplomatic and reconstruction efforts in Gaza and in Lebanon, where the president has previously complained that too many people are being killed by Israeli strikes. Israel has taken recent steps in both places. In Lebanon, where the Israeli military occupies much of the south, Israel agreed to allow the Lebanese army to deploy to some villages as part of a pilot program, testing their ability to secure areas where Hezbollah once operated. The U.S. State Department said Monday that the next round of the talks between Israel and Lebanon will take place next week in Rome, with a focus on expanding the program. On Gaza, Israel's Security Cabinet greenlit on Sunday a measure that would, in theory, grant entry to the first members of the International Stabilization Force outlined last year in a U.S.-backed ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Few countries have pledged troops for the force, however, and Israel would approve their entry into Gaza on a case-by-case basis. The troops, including from Morocco and Uganda, would only be allowed to operate in a small, desolate area in Rafah in the south, where the plan is to vet and house some displaced Palestinians. The Israeli military continues to carry out strikes, it says, target militants, but that have also killed civilians. Support for Israel has eroded. Israel has lost a significant amount of bipartisan support in the United States, particularly over its conduct in Gaza. Near the White House, where the public was able to gather near fencing, a small group of protesters chanted, "Netanyahu, you're a tyrant, and Bibi, you're not welcomed here," referencing the prime minister's nickname. An APNORC poll published earlier this month found a dramatic erosion of support from American adults for Israel. "We've lost America. Thank you, Bibi," wrote Ben Caspit, a political commentator for Israel's Ma'ariv newspaper. Over to you, Susan.
In the Tribune, New Hampshire in a minute. Dairy's annual pizza stock turns 10 on Saturday. Pizza Stock, one of Dairy's signature community events, will celebrate its 10th anniversary from noon to 6 p.m. Saturday, next to the football field at Pinkerton Academy. This year marks a milestone for the festival that serves as the largest annual fundraiser for the Jason R. Flood Memorial, promoting suicide prevention and mental health awareness among local youth. As always, the heart of the festival will be the 12 live bands performing nonstop across two stages, featuring local acts like Punching Pedestrians, Spectrum, Paradox, The Hand-Me-Downs, and Rite of Passage. Food includes pizza slices from Kendall Pond Pizza, refreshments from Just Chillin' and Cool Treats, and food options from Heaven's Kitchen. Carthasville Gameland, a dedicated backyard-style recreational game zone set up specifically for the festival, will feature classic lawn and backyard sports, most notably wiffle ball and cornhole, alongside the Taylor Library Kids Play Space. A community service row with tables from roughly 20 local organizations, including NAMI New Hampshire and New Futures, will provide local mental health and wellness resources. Large merchandise tables and raffle baskets will help raise funds for local groups like the Sunshine Soup Kitchen and the Boys and Girls Club. More information at pizzastock.org. Women's Bible Study returns August 4 in Kingston. The Women's Bible Study, having taken off the month of July, returns on August 4 with a study of Jen Wilkins' book, 10 Ways God is Different from Us. For several years now, the Women's Bible Study has been a happy place for women to come together to study the Bible in a non-denominational, helpful way. God's Word to us is a very helpful word, and studying it together reinforces that. The Women's Bible Study brings together across the experience spectrum. Some women have studied the Bible for years, while others have never done so. Everyone who wants to see what God has in store for them is invited to attend. Wilkins' book brings together Bible passages from several places to help readers see God is not just a bit bigger and a bit better than man, but is amazingly ready and able to make life better for all. The group meets Tuesdays starting August 4 and run through September 22. It's held at the Meeting House, the Yellow Building at 80 Route 125, Kingston, on the property of New Creation Healing Center and Trinity Church. Although the study is being held in a building of a particular church, the Bible study is open to everyone, and over the years, people from many different churches and none have attended. For more information, call Ronnie at 603-401-1209. Old Home Day, September 12 in Newton. Newton's annual Old Home Day will return Saturday, September 12, with a full day of family-friendly activities, entertainment, and community exhibits. The event will be held from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. behind Memorial School, 31 W Main Street. Visitors can explore exhibits from local businesses, nonprofit organizations, and community groups showcasing their products, services, and programs. The annual Classic Car Show also returns after drawing 35 vehicles last year. The Rockingham County Sheriff's Office and local police departments will present canine demonstrations throughout the day. Food vendors will include Goodfellas Grub, Heavenly Dogs and Catering, and Bumble and Straws LLC. Live music will be provided by local performers. Children can enjoy a petting zoo hosted by Alex and Burpees, featuring lambs, goats, rabbits, chickens, and other animals, as well as pony rides provided by CPM Stables. Additional activities include a dunk tank hosted by the Newton Police Department, face painting by Creatia Arts, balloon creations by Zaniacs, and a variety of carnival-style games. Attendees can also enter raffles featuring prizes donated by local businesses, including gift cards, plants, books, toys, and other items. Scarecrow kits will be available for purchase for those planning to participate in Newton's Community Halloween Scarecrow Contest. Individuals interested in becoming a vendor or donating a raffle prize can email recreation@newtonnh.net for more information. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up today with Today in History. In 1836, the newly completed Arc de Triomphe was inaugurated in Paris. In 1858, the United States and Japan signed the Harris Treaty, formalizing diplomatic relations and trading rights between the two countries. In 1890, artist Vincent van Gogh, 37, died of an apparent self-induced gunshot wound in Auvoir-sur-Oise, France. In 1914, transcontinental telephone service in the U.S. became operational with the first test conversation between New York and San Francisco. In 1921, Adolf Hitler became the leader of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. In 1954, the first volume of J.R.R. Tolkien's novel, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Rings, was published. In 1957, International Atomic Energy Agency was established. In 1958, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed the National Aeronautics and Space Act, creating NASA. In 1981, Prince Charles married Lady Diana Spencer in a glittering ceremony at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. In 1986, a federal jury in New York found that National Football League had committed an antitrust violation against the rival United States Football League, but the jury ordered the NFL to pay token damages of just $3. In 1994, abortion opponent Paul Hill shot and killed Dr. John Bayard Britton and Britton's escort, James H. Barrett, outside the Lady Center Clinic in Pensacola, Florida. In 2016, former suburban Chicago police officer Drew Patterson was given an additional 40 years in prison for trying to hire someone to kill the prosecutor who put him behind bars for killing his third wife. And lastly, in 2021, a newly arrived Russian science lab briefly knocked the International Space Center out of position when it accidentally fired its thrusters. For 47 minutes, the space station lost control of its orientation when the firing occurred after docking, altering a key position for communications and for getting power from its solar panels. And that concludes today's reading of the two newspapers. We thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, and for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlinds.org. This has been Diane and Susan, and we thank you for listening. Whatever you do this evening, be safe. Apparently, it's going to be kind of rainy for the next couple of days. So drive safely, keep your windows closed, and monitor whatever weather issues there are. And we wish you a good day, and we hope that you are kind to one another. Have a good evening, everyone.